Welcome to Conversations with Canadian Art Song Project, hosted by pianist Stephen Philcox and tenor Lawrence Williford.
Today we have Mary Morrison. I've had the pleasure of reading Walter Brintman's book about Mary and her husband, Harry Friedman, and it's been an extraordinary reading about your career. I came to this country 15 years ago, and so I don't have all the history in my back pocket of what things you've been doing. I urge especially young singers and young musicians who aren't really aware of what Mary did in her career to go and read this book by Walter Brintman.
Don't let me lose this thought. Yes. Have you read the book on Lawrence Marshall?
That's next on my list. It's on my shelf.
You should really read that. He was writing it for years. And it's very thorough.
Yeah. Well, I certainly have a copy on my shelf. We've been looking for as many books. What's going on in terms of vocal music in Canada? A lot of the information is coming out of biographies and whatnot of singers.
Absolutely. And, you know, Pittman, Walter, who recently
he
died.
He just passed away.
Yes.
Yeah.
He wrote one on Vic Felbrill. He wrote one on Louis Alpabaum. Right. Gwen Setterfield has an excellent one on Nicky Goldschmidt.
No.
Oh, it's terrific. She was a fine writer. Right. She's gone, too.
Yeah.
So there are all those books out there.
Yeah, yeah. It's actually very important for anybody who's listening and thinking about this.
Who's thinking about what went on in the past.
Yeah, and how that influences what's going on in the future.
And getting on with it.
Yeah, and I think that's important. But, you know, I'm just blown away by learning about all the things you've done in your life and your career and how you've influenced contemporary music, 20th century music, and a generation of singers in Canada. So we just want to have a fun conversation about where you started, how you began, and your career and your thoughts.
Yeah. I came from Winnipeg, and there are a lot of musicians, singers, everything, artists, dancers, theater people. You know, we had the first ballet company in Canada in Winnipeg,
right?
The professional one, and very good symphony and good education in the schools. In fact, fantastic education. We had every kind of choir going in the schools, and of course we had to audition and whatnot. And when I finally got to grade 10 or 9 or 10 or whatever it was, of course we had a GNS every year.
Mm. Yeah.
So with the students. Fantastic background, because it was fun. Because we had a lot of Brits, of course.
Yes,
and
of course.
A huge Scottish family.
Right.
Community.
Can you just talk about, so it's my understanding your parents were immigrants.
My parents, yes, emigrated. My father was from very high in the Isle of Lewis, called the Butt of Lewis, right? Anyway, of course, he spoke the Gaelic. And that's how I started singing, actually, because he wanted me to sing the Gaelic songs.
Uh-huh.
And I was actually 8 years old when I won some kind of a competition. They used to broadcast that competition to Scotland, up to the north. Yes,
right.
Yes. And then my mother was from Aberdeen, and that's the Lowland Scots. So then there was all the Banks and Brays and all the Loch Lomonds. And they never had the benefit of anything like the education that I had. And they certainly didn't have any music education. So they were determined that my sister and I, my sister was 2 years younger, we were to have the benefit of everything they didn't have, if they could afford it. We were poor. My mother worked and my father worked.
So they weren't musicians themselves?
Not at all. Not at all. But they loved music. And, you know, I think that whole community, and it also happened in the Ukrainian community and Polish. Winnipeg was a real mixture of things. And I lived in the South End, and the Jewish people and the Polish and the Ukrainians, most of them lived in the North End.
Right.
So we never had a car. We never went to movies. There was no money. In the winter, we skated. That was our entertainment. And going to these Scottish gatherings where we would have concerts. I would say at least every 2 weeks, if not more often. And so we had all these opportunities to perform the Gaelic songs and the Lowland Scottish music. And we would do the concerts.
And this was your introduction to performing?
Yeah, yes.
Okay.
Oh, yes, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was, eight when
yeah.
I was doing this.
Yeah, yeah.
This is bizarre. No.
And presumably then the church connection would probably be very strong as well.
Oh,
then, as
yes,
well. So
yes.
The music in the church was
yes.
in that community.
Oh,
yeah.
Very much so. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, I was singing in choirs yeah. from day one, you know. And also, if I can ever put a plug in to get singers and musicians to read music, because it's so important.
Yeah,
that's where I started.
Yeah.
And that's how I earned my living eventually. I could read pretty fast and sometimes accurate.
There was a part of your life in Winnipeg that was really enormous, your exposure to the media and whatnot.
Well, I had my own radio show. At first, I was a member of a 16-voice choir with Jeffrey Waddington conducting.
Mm-hmm.
I was the baby in the group. And we had a regular weekly show called Just a Song. And that led to my own radio show, always with a tenor or a baritone, and it was called Sweethearts, also with an orchestra. And that was a weekly thing.
Were you in charge of what the music...
No.
The conductor
chose the music, and well, he would ask if we wanted to do that, and he also chose whether it was a tenor or a baritone.
Mm-hmm.
So that went on for a year. We sang Cole Porter, Jerome Kern.
Yeah, but you were doing the popular music at the time, certainly.
Yes. But at the same time, I was doing the festival.
Winnipeg,
Manitoba Music Festival is pretty huge, one of the largest in the country, and we always had adjudicators from England, big British component in that, and a lot of the teachers were
British.
My teacher was Welsh, and that Manitoba Music Festival, of course, I won all the prizes when I was 17.
Yeah.
The big one is the Rose Bowl, and I've since had, I don't know how many students have won that Rose Bowl, which is top one. And no money, maybe a scholarship.
I think I read somewhere, now I forget all the names of the competitions, but you were the first and last person to win on all of the all the important competitions, and they decided they couldn't do that anymore in the future.
That's right, it was different categories.
Oh,
they
yeah.
had a soprano B, a soprano A, and then they had folk songs, and you know,
incredible.
Oratorio. Then I graduated from high school and came to Toronto.
Amazing. And so that was all in your latter teens.
Yes. I left Winnipeg when I was 17. I came in the fall to Toronto, and I would have been 18 in November. So when I came to Toronto, I had church jobs, every other kind of job, just to earn a living.
Yeah.
I lived at the Y, and then I finally moved into, when I was at the conservatory, I moved into the residence of the conservatory, which was down on Ord Street.
Were people aware of you? Your voice is already recognizable on the CBC, certainly regionally.
Oh, yes.
Uh-huh.
I still have people who recognize me.
So you came to Toronto. You were, from what I understand, brought by Vinci, Dr.
Well,
Vinci?
I had scholarships to the conservatory. And I studied with Dr. Vinci. I also had leader with Emmy Heim, Greta Kraus, and Weldon Kilburn was a coach for piano, and he was Lois Marshall's mentor and eventually her husband. And so at that time, also, the men from the armed forces were coming back and using up their DVA credits by studying music and trying to make a headway. And there were composers there, including my husband.
Yes. Harry Friedman.
And I don't think Harry Summers was in the sources. He wasn't. He was here. And so they were all studying with whoever it might have been. It might have been Willen. It might have been Rideout. Godfrey Rideout. Or it might have, it mostly was Weinzweig.
Right.
And then Louis Applebaum was also there at that time. Big film composer. And we had a lot of opportunities to work with these musicians.
It seems a hugely exciting time in terms of...
It was, absolutely.
Yeah.
Can
you talk a little bit about that, what it was like post-war? There's a desire for creating a kind of Canadian cultural scene.
Well, I think these composers that were there at that time, let's say there was Summers, Beckwith, Friedman, Moravitz, people who wrote for radio. Yeah. You know, they had commissions,
yeah.
and the Canada Council eventually got in there.
Right.
But there was a group of them that formed a board, say, and they would devise programs, and they went to Boston with these programs. We traveled with
yeah.
this. Yeah,
a contemporary
kind of
music.
Contemporary
yeah.
music,
right.
I think. That's the first one that I remember. At that time, there were so many singers also. There was Lois Marshall,
right.
and Elizabeth Benson Guy, Robert Goulet, oh gosh, Bernie Johnson. And these composers had something to say, and they wanted their music heard, of course.
Yeah.
So they would ask me if I would go and read it through with
yeah.
them. They sat at the piano or whatever instrument they played. That's how I started doing the contemporary idiom.
So what was that collaboration like?
Oh, it was
the exploration
magic.
Must have been amazing at that time. But
what was the
relationship between that the composer and singer, composer and other musicians? Were they taking your thoughts?
They would ask.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Well, do you think this works?
Yeah.
Or is that better? You know,
yeah.
they were very flexible. You know, because they were experimenting,
certainly.
And you know, unless their music is heard, then it's no good just on paper. And you have to have some connection. You have to have a way in.
Mm-hmm.
And we had it. And at the same time, you know, the CBC was commissioning works. And there was the CBC Opera. There was the CLC.
Yeah. So that's also a major part of your story. You were part of the beginning of the CBC Opera.
Yeah.
The opera companies
the
being
opera festival it was to begin with,
and then into
and
the,
then
the COC
it became the COC.
I mean, there's a lot of things going on at this time. This is the 40s, early
50s.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes. Well, my first opera was Eurydice at Eaton Auditorium. You know, much later when Stravinsky came, we recorded. At Eaton Auditorium.
Really?
Columbia loved Eaton Auditorium.
Oh, kidding.
We did Symphony of Psalms. We did all this Stravinsky stuff.
Yeah.
With Stravinsky here.
Incredible.
And then he finally came to the CBC on his 82nd birthday, I think it was, and conducted again. But it was television by then.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm getting way ahead of
myself. No, but it's all... I mean, this is kind of an image of what how exciting this time
but
was.
But it was exciting.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like it was something you were just naturally drawn to. Like there was just this kind of innate curiosity in you too.
The curiosity...
To explore.
That's a very good word. I was always very curious.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which is why I also did jazz. I did backup singers because I could go in. I did jingles. Everyone
sure.
will say, what a car, you know. these were the General Motors things.
Yes.
We used to tour with it,
of
with
course.
Howard Cable.
Yeah. Amazing.
Yes.
Absolutely amazing.
And Jello. I remember doing a Jello.
Incredible.
Oh, dear. But then we got residuals from doing...
Yeah. Well, those
that's
were the
my
days.
Living. If you, and then there was Star Time, Showtime, the Boyne and Schuster show. These were weekly
yeah.
shows
mm-hmm.
that they wanted singers for.
Right.
So basically, in the early 50s, you were doing opera work, you were doing choral work in
the
city.
It was the festival singers.
And the festival
mm-hmm.
singers. You were doing tours around the country with CBC organizations. You were
right.
doing shows with the CBC.
Right.
You were so diversified in all of the things you did.
Yes, well.
We lose sight now of what it's like to be a working musician in more than just kind of one vein.
I don't
and
think they have the
yeah.
the opportunity. They
mm.
have. There is a lot going on now.
Mm-hmm.
I know there is. But whether the singers and musicians have access to all these things. There, you know, there was a for the CBC, they had radio orchestras.
Yeah.
They had a CBC symphony also.
Yeah.
And they had regular shows, so the musicians were working, and now there's nothing
yeah.
like that. And our really well-known radio and television producers, like David Jager, who just got
mm-hmm.
the Award
yes.
for Canada,
yes.
and Neil Crorey,
right.
I mean, they're
no.
out of a job.
Yep.
And there was also a lot of film going on. Film was pretty big at that time. They had the National Film Board. Yes. As a matter of fact, they they filmed A City Sings, one of the first National Film Board things, which I sang on. But
yeah.
it's still around, and I have a copy somewhere.
Oh, brilliant. Brilliant. Well, hold on to that.
That's
you never know what's going to disappear.
National Film Board.
Yeah.
Yes.
So you're doing all of these different things, and you have your opera career going on. How long did you prioritize the opera part of your career?
took time off and had three kids.
Yes, which mm-hmm. is not small.
And a composer husband. Oh,
yeah.
Who played in the symphony, of course.
Yeah.
And then I came back to do a Figaro, it seems to me, but I don't remember the year.
Right. Right. And that was part of the COC.
That was the COC. Yes, yes, yes. But the other ones I did, you know, there was. Oh, there was, Bohème was the first one, really. Mm-hmm. The first
Canada's movie. Mimi, from what I recall you being
right.
called.
And remember my trip to Europe when, as Miss Opera or whatever I was.
Yes, that's right.
Yes, well, we went to all the Milan, Rome, Covent Garden, and Paris. And all I had to do was appear in that wardrobe,
that's
a
amazing.
Nylon wardrobe, at these big performances of opera. I heard Flagstaff, actually.
Amazing.
Mm.
In one of the Wagners, I don't know. It wasn't Tristan. I was hoping it would be, but it wasn't.
Yeah, so that was, I mean, then that was your first exposure to European
yeah.
opera houses.
Yeah, well, yes. And then in 1968, 1967 was a big year for composers for
oh,
all
yeah,
performances
absolutely.
Here.
So know? That was the centenary celebration
yes,
of,
that
of Canada.
Yes, that was huge,
right.
yes. And we performed everywhere. But big performances in Ottawa, where they brought all the European operas
uh-huh.
to perform
oh,
in
wow.
Montreal for that 1967. Incredible. So I hadn't heard a lot of European contemporary music.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, it's time I did something. I had heard Kathy Barbarian. She was the only one I had heard because she was married to a composer that we all knew, Luciano Berio.
Yeah.
And so I applied for a grant from the Canada Council to go to all the contemporary music festivals that were occurring in the fall. So I was away for 3 months. I think I had $1,300 travel money from lived on Arthur Frommer's $5 a day or whatever it was
yeah.
at that time. And I lived in hostels. And I just went from one festival to another.
And this was in?
1968, because right. I just wanted to hear more contemporary music. And I heard fantastic performances, where audiences just walked out.
Yeah.
I can remember being at one performance in Warsaw. I'm not sure if it was at that time because I was in Warsaw several times,
mm-hmm.
Where there was a piano duo playing a piece of Morton Feldman. And you both know Morton Feldman's
yeah.
music. It is endless.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, these wonderful pianists got up on the stage and we were all in the audiences. And it went on and it went on and on. And people dropped their keys, they coughed and they...
the rappers,
papers,
the
and rappers.
Yeah.
Finally, the two pianists just stood up, put down the lids, and stormed off. That was it. We never heard the final thing. But that's quite typical in those festivals, you
yeah.
know.
Mm.
If they don't like it,
yeah.
they Done. Make you know.
Right.
Mm.
So this is kind of your first experience getting out of Canada and really hearing
yes,
what is going
absolutely.
On outside of North America in the new music.
Mm-hmm.
And this is
mm-hmm.
late 60s.
Mm-hmm.
So by then you've stopped doing opera. You've kind of taken time away from
family. Oh, yes.
From
I think maybe...
And,
oh,
yeah.
I wish I had those
things. Well, the balancing.
Anyway,
it
would be maybe 62 is my
yeah.
last.
Yeah,
somewhere
okay.
in there,
okay.
maybe, opera.
And you had three children, and you had a composer husband.
Husband.
And so you're juggling all
Somebody
of these
had to
things.
Come and look after my kids
yeah.
while I was away, because
Incredible.
Harry was there, but not there. Yeah, but it was a fantastic trip.
Yeah.
It just opened so many ideas for me.
It's it's an incredible time in musical culture,
mm-hmm.
Late 60s, early 70s. There's more money now, as you said, as a result of the centenary celebration.
Yes.
There's money going into commissions.
Absolutely.
There's a lot of energy. The establishment of the Canadian League of Composers is there.
Oh, yes.
You have the Canada Council and the other
Absolutely.
Arts councils. So,
so
money's
can,
coming in.
So can, you know, the publishers and, you know,
yeah.
yes.
So you get involved and you basically go and have this experience in Europe. And what's the thing you take away from this?
Well, I had to write a report, of course.
I'm not saying you should give us the verbal version of the report. But personally, what do you come away with after hearing all
well,
this?
Well, I was just so excited about the whole thought of maybe doing some of their music,
yeah.
for me
yeah.
to do some of their music and see what I would bring to it, because I'd heard their singers and performers do it. And so then also, you know, my connection with the Lyric Arts Trio was sort of at that same time. We started in 1964.
And that includes?
That's Robert Aitken, his wife Marion Ross, and me. We were already getting programs together and broadcasts, tours. And we did many
domestic
tours.
And international tours.
Yes, yeah. yes, yeah. oh yes. Iceland was very big on our program. And
and mostly Canadian music?
Well, towards the end, we tried to have a good portion of Canadian music if we thought that it was appropriate.
You know? Right.
Wherever we went, we would do some German or French or whatever, and Icelandic. Japanese,
incredible.
Yes, uh-huh. you know, so.
American.
And American, yes. We were in the States, not as much in the States as in Europe or Japan. We were in Japan three or four times. I can't
but mostly contemporary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
you know, we would throw in the odd Handel.
Sure, right.
Handel or earlier.
Right.
Because somehow the very early music and contemporary music
Yeah,
very
yeah.
Well.
They're a good compliment.
Yeah. Yes. And they just enlarged everything for us.
Right.
But there were no agents, of course, for our type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't know what to do with us. We tried to get an agent. We tried several. And we did it all ourselves. We wrote the letters. Bob had a lot of contacts with other musicians and composers, because Bob is a composer, too.
Yes.
And... that's Bob Aitken. And so we wrote the letters.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wrote the letters and figured out what we had to be paid in order to get there and to do the concert. So that was no small feat.
No. Mm-hmm. So you're doing all of this contemporary repertoire, and Lyric Arts Trio becomes a very significant ensemble, not only to your career, but just in internationally and in
well,
Canada.
Well, composers from everywhere wrote for us, you know. That was really exciting to hear what they heard and for us to try and figure out, well, is this what they wanted?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
Because you can't help but put your own sort of feeling about the music, but really it's what the composer intends.
That's an interesting
and the
topic.
Text.
Yeah, that's an interesting topic in and of itself. I mean, the difference between... when a composer writes something, puts it on a sheet of paper, what is it that they're bringing?
Exactly.
And what supersedes that, or what the artist who is going to interpret what that
That's
is
right.
on the page?
The composers were generally, they wanted their performances, and the performer, there's a lot of responsibility if you're doing a first performance.
A premiere, yes, absolutely.
Whether that piece will have a life.
Absolutely.
And... whether it's worthy of life. So you have to make sure that you've done your research but you have to have ideas of your own too, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It can't be often what you hear now on a record. And, you know, our students listen to so many records.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And you wonder how much of their own they bring to these things. Do you think, I often wonder if in my time we had to do it ourselves. We didn't have all the people who coached us and did all these things.
Mm-hmm.
We had to experiment and find our way.
Right.
Yeah, you really had to discover repertoire from the ground up.
That's right.
You know,
and the technique and beyond.
Right.
It was new in every regard.
And if composers heard us doing Canadian work that they liked, then they would write something in their genre, you know.
I mean, the number of premieres that you must have been a part of.
Oh, huge.
Throughout
did
your
you,
career.
Did you ever keep track of
oh,
that?
Yeah. I think it's all in that
it's
Encyclopedia
in the
of Canada,
oh.
But up to a certain point, because that came out in 1967. It was a great time, I must. Now that I'm forced to think back on it, it was really amazing.
Well, one of the things I find very interesting in terms of the work that Stephen and I are doing with Canadian Arts Fund Project is we've been going and trying to find the repertoire that's for voice and piano. You know, at this time, mid to late 60s, early 70s, you're getting a lot of commissions. There's a lot of new music being written for your voice specifically.
Yeah.
But there's it's mostly chamber repertoire. In the kind of survey that we've been doing, most of the repertoire is chamber repertoire. There's very little of that time that really stands out that's piano and voice. So we have this recital culture that is its own thing, that's kind of looked at, that salon culture. But what you were doing is a very different type of music making in a way. And the energy, what was going on in Canada, and frankly, in Europe as well, seemed not to focus on that salon tradition, but in this new music, chamber music tradition.
Chamber music.
Can you talk a little bit about kind of what you know of what was going on in terms of the music being written for the voice, for chamber music, for you and for other singers at the time? And maybe why there isn't repertoire for just voice and piano of that time.
Part of it might be, as far as chamber music is concerned, is that nowadays, I mean, there are a number of contemporary ensembles or organizations.
Yeah.
There's Array Music, and there's Larry Cherney's
Soundstream.
And New Music Concerts, which has been going now for something like 40 years, maybe more.
Yeah.
Oh, more. If you have a group of musicians who are like-minded, and they want to do that kind of thing. But I don't know how much of that happens now. Are you aware of that?
Who's pursuing having new music written, is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Well, I think there's energy. Certainly Canadian Arts and Project we're commissioning multiple things a year. And
But you have to get money.
Yeah,
you have to raise
indeed.
Money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, I see. So you're just saying just the relationships coming and building into
and
music.
You know, in my time, when I in the early 50s, say, we had a group that used to meet up in Thornhill at Rolly Pack's house. He was a wonderful cellist, the first cellist of the symphony. He played all the early music. He even built his own portative organ. His wife was a pianist as well. And we would meet at his place and read through Bach cantatas. We'd get a flute player, a violin, or oboe, or whatever. Yeah. Harry would come play oboe. And we would do this regularly.
Yeah.
But I don't think that happens now. Just for fun, we did it.
No, I think some musicians have the time and energy and desire to do that, the kind of social music making.
Yeah.
But I think everybody's so busy and so torn in different directions and trying to chase the next thing. And I would even say, it sounds like what you're describing in terms of new music being written, you'd have these relationships that would just accumulate in kind of into a new piece.
Well, they were all my friends.
Right, so into a new piece. So, and I just don't think that, with apologies to all my composer friends, there's a desire and a reasonable expectation to be paid for the work that they do. But it's a different time. You're not just going to sit down and write music for your friends in a way. And sometimes that happens as a result of not getting the funding that you hope for.
Yes.
And they just kind of sign it off to, all right, well, you know, on to the next thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there is a different culture in kind of music making. So that might be it.
I have a question for you, either one of you.
Yeah.
What about improvised music?
Uh-huh.
Because sometimes when you're involved in a new piece, you end up improvising. I can think of lots of times that we improvise.
Mm-hmm. I do think it's something that we don't do enough of.
Absolutely.
I think
I was in Banff in November for a project, and I was forced to improvise in a concert. And
it's
something that I'm not very used to, but it opened up channels in me that I didn't realize were there. So,
exactly.
You know, and it was fascinating to me.
And what about you, Lauren?
So I haven't improvised in that way since I've been a soloist. But in my ensemble days, I was a group that I helped start called Contus, and it's based in Minneapolis, St. Paul. And we did a couple pieces that were completely improvised. Even on stage, every night we would do this. So, and it, you know, it creates an incredible energy, actually. You're relating to your friends and colleagues and other musicians in a very different way. You have to be so attentive.
And it's spontaneous.
Yeah, and it's had a massive
And the way it makes you listen, too.
Yeah. Oh,
I mean,
absolutely.
You have to listen.
My youngest daughter, you know, this is how she earns her living, improvising.
Yes,
yeah.
And she travels. She's just been in Japan. She's in England sometimes. She's in the States. She's everywhere. But, you know.
No, that's interesting, though, because that also, you don't know what you're capable of until you just kind of put yourself in that unknown space. That's an interesting interesting question for us. But I mean, clearly that has opened doors for you and the work that you are doing and how.
Oh yes, yes, yes.
You
yes,
were
yes.
able to use your voice in different capacities and, mm. and explore.
Like an instrument.
Yes.
I mean,
yeah.
My own husband, in particular, he just thought of the voice like an orchestral mm. instrument.
Mm-hmm.
And so very often he had a terrible time trying to find texts that he wanted to set. Mm. And so mm. he would just have oohs and ahs, you know.
That brings me to another question for you. You're dealing with a lot of composers, actually, at that time. That's how they use text, as a vehicle for the voice
mm-hmm.
as an instrument. So how did you approach that? Basically, you're dealing with something completely different. In that the music of the 20th century, you're dealing with a lot of repertoire that uses text as a vehicle
yeah.
rather
and
than text.
Quite often, the composers are just ridiculous. So, you know, as far as the range is concerned, you know, they'll put an A below middle C and then go up to high C, above, you know.
On an E vowel.
On, exactly. Well, first of all, some of them don't understand the voice. It is a physical thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, it's not like playing an instrument where it's already there for you.
But did you bring a different kind of sensibility than when you're dealing with text to communicate something specific, like Schubert or...
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. For myself, I always tried to find my way in.
Yeah.
That I hadn't heard a recording or, you know, whatever. So I wasn't influenced at all. But, you know, the way the composer has a line, or if it's jagged, then you have some other different color you can put in. You know,
yeah.
it's never the same twice. That's what we discovered with our trio. We would experiment a lot.
And how were you exposed to the more traditional leader repertoire? The song repertoire? Was it through your formal education?
Yes,
or,
absolutely. Oh, yes. In Winnipeg, when I was growing up, it was Handel
mm-hmm.
And all in Bach, a lot of Handel and Bach. Big Mennonite connection there in Winnipeg, you know, and they sing from the day one, I think.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And a lot of British composers. Earlier ones like Quilter and, you know, people like that.
Yeah.
But it seems to me that even in your generation, that there was less opportunity for the traditional just piano and voice recital. Because things were really kind of exploding.
Certainly in the 60s they were exploding.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I think in the early 50s it was still quite, I mean, when I was at the conservatory in the senior school, which was like their graduate school, there was Lois Marshall and myself
mm-hmm.
and Libby, and
yeah.
we did all the leader and French melody
yeah.
and British composers.
And who would play for you?
Who would play? Well, Mario Bernardi was around, and he was a wonderful pianist.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow. Leo Barkin was the symphony pianist. He often played for me.
Okay.
Yvonne Guiguet, that's a name you probably
no.
don't know. She was married to Richard Johnson, who was the dean of music out in Calgary, but she was young. All these people were younger than me. Anyway, but it was that that level. Excellent pianists at the conservatory.
Mm.
Because we had, for the singers, it was Emmy Heim and Greta Krause.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And my teacher was Dr. Vinci, of course.
Yeah.
And there was George Lambert. Later, Diamant came. Diamant and Madame Jessner, Irene Jessner, who had had a big career in New York.
What was the transition for you like, going from being performer to, and having, frankly, you had a really significant career. So what that transition from performer into teacher and leading this new generation of voices, we just
what?
Celebrated you and Barbara, Misha's one of
amazing.
Your students. There's just a Tracy Dahl, I believe.
Tracy
studying.
Adrian Pajanka.
Yeah, Adrian.
Yes.
Oh,
John Tessier.
Exactly. There's just
endless.
So many.
Yeah.
So many.
It's fun.
So what was that transition like, and what's it been like to be a teacher?
I used to think I would never teach.
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
The musicians, mostly, would say, "Are you teaching? Aren't you teaching?"
Mm.
You know, I do something and I say, "Oh, I'm too busy," or, you know, "I have a family," and this, that, and the other thing. And it was a colleague of mine whom I knew in Winnipeg. She used to sing on that very first Just a Song show, and she taught at McMaster. And she was either retiring or going away or something, and she said, "Would I take her class?" Because she didn't know any other people, but she knew me from Winnipeg. So I said, oh, yeah, it was like one day a week or something. Right. So I said, and I had a great time teaching. It was like music education, and John Fanning was in that class.
And now he's teaching.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
They're all teaching now. That led me to teach at Western for 7 years. I made that lovely 401 track.
Right.
And then I taught for, I think, half a day here at the faculty in maybe 78. But it just sort of rolled. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, it certainly wasn't anything I was doing. I wasn't looking
for a
job.
So as you're kind of performing less and less.
Yeah.
But initially, you're performing just as much and then taking on.
Yes, but I only had so much
time
and energy
to
teach. I enjoyed it, though. I loved it, actually, and I still love it.
And do you have any sort of general observations or kind of ideas to pass on to a wider audience of students that in terms of being a singer today? You were so media savvy when you were younger. We're in a very media-heavy
universe. Well, but I had the opportunities. I don't know what opportunities will be there for these kids. And there are many more singers now. Many more. And probably many more musicians.
Yes.
Yeah. The university's turning out, such good people. Well, first of all, singers have to learn to read. They have to be able to read. And I find even here, some of them don't read very well. And they just have to look at the structure of the music. If they've had some kind of background, they have to have some background in order to be able to recognize whether this is going to work or it won't work or whatever. If they're going to write for a voice, finding good texts, and it has to be texts of now.
One of the things I'm terribly struck by is the importance of making music of your period, of your time.
Definitely.
And how important that was to your career and all the other musicians, frankly, of your generation.
Absolutely. I think that they have to want to be part of the scene with their music. Well, it takes a long time to develop develop the voice.
Absolutely.
And the musicality along with it.
Yeah.
And then you have to branch out and find something maybe different.
Be your own artist.
You want to do.
Have something to say. Yeah.
Do you think audiences back then were different than they are now? More receptive to the music of now?
I think it depended on who was doing the performing.
I mean,
whether they were receptive or not, and if they believed. But I think if the audience believed what they were trying to perform, they would go with it. And I think maybe even today they do. A lot rests on the performer.
I personally have just, in the past couple of years, have become a father and am balancing being an artist, father, good spouse. That part of your life clearly had a significant impact for both you and your husband. Can you just maybe give a little bit of what it was like and how you decided how to balance your life? It's clear. I mean, it's clear you mostly stayed in Canada. You toured and
did whatnot. I chose to do that because I didn't. First of all, I was not competitive. I sang in competitions, but I don't think I was very competitive. Yeah. I'm still not very competitive. And our home life, we had a big house, usually, because of three kids. And Harry had to have absolute quiet, so I couldn't practice at home. I'd have to go practice somewhere else.
Amazing.
It was either a church or I would be practicing here or the conservatory or wherever. And when we were on tour, I always had to find somewhere to practice.
Yeah.
Sometimes in the roof of a hotel or whatever. And my kids were all studying music also.
Yeah.
So it wasn't easy for them because they wanted to play their recordings of their pop music or whatever was prevalent at that time.
Yeah.
And Harry had to have absolute quiet.
Yeah.
He was a composer. Yeah. That was his life.
So that was a big, big thing.
It was a big
space
issue.
Yeah.
Yes. And he, when I first knew him, he thought the voice was fine and whatnot. But he had, not disdain, but he didn't think that singers were very good musicians.
Well,
he had to change his tune. And this was a laughing joke when we got married, that he was marrying a singer amongst the musicians. Right. It was hilarious.
Yeah.
And anybody would tell you that. But then he gradually grew to acknowledge the fact that it was an art.
Well, he wrote several pieces for you.
Oh, yes.
Obviously.
Yeah. And for a lot of choir, he has a lot of choir music, yes.
Yeah.
But he's still, in my way of thinking, he's still an instrumental, symphony or chamber music. Mm-hmm. That's where he shone.
Space was a major concern for you all. But,
Yes.
So that was a big part of balancing. But also just the decision, maybe you've already answered the question, not being competitive, but the decision to basically make your home Toronto, to be a part of the community of music making here, and to focus on that and balance the...
I don't think I was thinking of being a big star somewhere.
Yeah.
But it also speaks to the point that there was enough happening locally.
That's right.
To make a career.
Best
you
of
didn't
all
have
possible
to search
worlds.
Beyond the borders of
and
where you were.
The organizations, we didn't need an agent.
Right.
The organizations came to us.
Mm-hmm.
They would phone or they would write a letter and say, would you be interested in doing this, that, and the other, including the COC.
Yeah.
And the symphony and the CBC. Well, that's the way I may have done one or two auditions, but they were because they wanted to hear an audition. But
right.
I didn't seek auditions. Now that is very different.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, our performers today have to be entrepreneurs and seek auditions. And they do. It's a way of life for them. And you?
Well, and so many of them are having to make their own opportunities.
Absolutely, but that's a good thing.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, for sure.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the ones that really want it, they will do that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like we did our trailer. We lived on the same street.
Yeah. In Walter's book, he implies that you and Harry felt a really strong pull to be a part of a social group of artists, and it was important to be a part of that community. Do you recognize that as part of why you're called to be an artist? Your activity in the cultural life of the city and of the country?
Well, I don't know about today, but in our day, the composers and the singers and the musicians, we were all great friends. We socialized with Maureen would give a big party or we would have a party, and it was the same people that went through all these things.
Yeah.
And they were composers, they were musicians, painters, Harold Town would be there, and it was just, that was the time.
Yeah.
I don't know if that happens now.
A much smaller community that was very
yes.
closely knit.
And a bunch of us lived in Rosedale, so
we all
went from one house
right.
to the
mm-hmm. Right. But a cross-section of cultural arts.
Oh, absolutely. Like, since Harry, my husband Harry, also painted.
Yes,
he was
absolutely.
A fine
right.
artist.
Well, he studied as an artist.
Oh, yes. He Lemoyne Fitzgerald, one of the, I think he was on the fringe of the Group of Seven.
Yeah.
But Harry studied with him and also studied art with Dennis Burton here, who's a good artist. There would be the musicians, the singers, the painters, the dancers.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was. Yeah. It was maybe a tighter knit thing. I don't know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to describe that.
Yeah.
I think I told you about Friedman and Summers. They would go to each other's first performances, and then there would be a great hurrahs, and whichever one, if it was a Summers piece. Then Friedman would stand up.
Right, right.
And they just did it all the time. I mean,
that's
they were
so
really
good.
Such good friends.
So good.
And then there was the actress, because Summers, of course, he was married to Barbara Chilcott Davies.
Oh,
and, of course, there was the whole acting community in our thing. Mm-hmm. And we used to do these. We had a group that sang at weddings and showers or whatever.
Yeah.
Any kind of gathering. We would get together, and somebody would write lyrics, one of the composers would pen something, and somebody would have to sing them. I mean,
so
I don't think that happens.
No, not in that way anymore. It's a shame, actually.
Yeah.
Is there anything else that you want to make sure that you have a chance to talk about in terms of song, in terms of music, voice, about being a part of the cultural landscape of Canada, about the importance of artists, anything?
Well, I think if you're going to be a sincere artist, you have to know what it is you want to say in your way and not be influenced by something you hear. But you have to be a musician if you're going to be a singer, too. And that's not given to everybody.
Yeah.
I think it speaks to the sense of discovery, too. Our students today are kind of handed things on a platter.
Absolutely.
You know, and so there's not this sense
of
kind of...
They don't have to search
for... Of searching, right. Yeah, kind of finding
think,
the deeper layers.
What would that be like?
Yeah. Well, Mary... Thank you so much for spending time.
Yeah, that was fabulous.
An exposé.